Delighted to welcome tonight Professor Colin Ward, who in fact has taught for most of his working life at the tough end of post-school education and further education, and has also been the editor of the Bulletin for Environmental Education for the Town and Country Planning Association. However, he emerged in the last 20 or 30 years as the leading and most forceful, in the non-violent sense, advocate of anarchist principles in Britain. As a result of over 20 books, he's, I suspect, managed to persuade rather more than the 400 or so people that he said in 1970 he'd like to convert to anarchism to something like that position. The books give a good idea of his range. They include books with titles such as Tenants Take Over, Anarchy in Action, a book published in 1973 and still in print, translated into several languages, The Child in the City, The Child in the Country, a pioneering book on vandalism, Freedom to Go After the Motor Age, Street Work, The Exploding School, The Allotment, Its Landscape and Culture, Good Night Campers, A Social History of the Holiday Camp, Undermining the Central Line, written with Ruth Rendell, not a murder story, but an attack on central government over dominance, and Welcome Thinner City on Urban Issues. These are just the key books, and there are several others. As well as that, Colin edited 118 issues of Anarchy in the 1960s, which was in fact my introduction to him. I remember Raphael Samuel, who I think is here tonight, told me that issue number 4 on prisons was the best thing that he'd ever read on prisons, because somehow adopting anarchist principles freed people to look at these questions completely anew. And indeed, I went and got hold of the issue and was very taken by it, and read and became an Anarchy subscriber ever since. And no less a social observer than Colin McInnes, in fact, called it the most original monthly that I know of in its perceptions of shifting social trends. And that freshness, that originality, Colin Ward has maintained in his column in New Society, and then in the New Statesman and Society as it became. However, that column now sadly will be no longer continued under new ownership. I suppose that will be now known as the New Stakeholder. However, you can still read him in the pages of Freedom. So, I'm more than delighted to welcome Professor Colin Ward to give his centenary lecture on anarchism in the 21st century.
Well, of course, I have to begin by congratulating the London School of Economics on its centenary, and I need to add a second grateful word of praise to the school as an institution in inviting a rather marginal person like me as a visitor. It's given me a great deal of pleasure, most especially because of the stimulating encounters I've continually had during this year in this academic rabbit warren. Now, you will know better than me that any institution like yours gets associated with the opinions of vocal professors, so that a teaching and learning body has, in the outside world, been seen not as an academy of free inquiry, but as a megaphone for the views of particular teachers. Even in my own lifetime, for example, I've learnt that the LSE was a mouthpiece of Fabian managerial centralism, or of automatic robot Marxism, or alternately, of course, of propaganda for unrestricted free market capitalism. Naturally, I'm aware that all these views are caricatures, associating particular teachers with the institution that employs them. But of course, I'm bound to ask, what has become of the centralizing bureaucratic Fabianism of the Webbs, or of Lasky's Marxism, or of von Hayek's road to serfdom, when it's obvious to all of us today that the aim of the flexible labour market of today's economy is to reduce us all to the all-too-real serfdom of child labour in the poorest corners of global exploitation. We've inherited the Christian calendar, and one historical trend it brings with it is the tendency for outbursts of revivalism towards the end of centuries, especially noted at the end of millennia and semi-millennia. And I make this generalisation from the period leading up to the year 1000 or the year 1500. And we've got another of these accidental turning points coming up. And since we live in a secular age, in the West at least, the revival has been expressed in commercial rather than in spiritual terms. Of course, I'm talking about the religion of market values, which has swept across with the fervour of the Protestant Reformation or of Methodism at the end of the 18th century or evangelical revivalism at the end of the 19th. Everybody here will be aware that it's even changed our language and consequently the way we think about goods and services. To me, I find something rather sinister and frightening about the sheer speed with which in so many fields in which relationships based on an ideology of reciprocity and mutual obligation have been replaced by real, or where necessary, simulated market values. Now, you and I, of course, have watched the ebb and flow of many a fashion and know that the evangelical phase of the current worship of the market isn't going to last. For the same reasons that impelled the early 19th century sanitary reformers in the age of laissez-faire to report on the horrors of the old sanctification of the market, or for that matter Engels to write his book on the condition of the working classes in England. People will have to invent alternatives in the 21st century, just as they were in the 19th. One of these alternatives is undoubtedly going to be anarchism. The word, as you know, means contrary to authority or without government. And for a definition of the political ideology of anarchism, I always turn to the article written by Peter Kropotkin for the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. He defined anarchism as the name given to a principle or theory of life and conduct under which society is conceived without government, harmony in such a society being obtained not by submission to law or by obedience to any authority, but by free agreements concluded between the various groups, territorial and professional, freely constituted for the sake of production and consumption, as also for the satisfaction of the infinite variety of needs and aspirations of a civilized being. I mean, you might say that's so broad a definition that it embraces everything, but I'm happy with it, since he adds his endorsement of the federal principle, explaining that this mode of social organisation in which local bodies would substitute themselves for the state would represent, he said, an interwoven network composed of an infinite variety of groups and federations of all sizes and degrees, local, regional, national and international, temporary or more or less permanent for all possible purposes. And he goes on with a long list of possible purposes. I also note that he was not describing some ideal society where history has come to a stop, since he adds that, moreover, such a society would represent nothing immutable. On the contrary, as is seen in organic life at large, harmony would, it is contended, result from an ever-changing adjustment and readjustment of equilibrium between the multitudes of forces and influences. And this adjustment would be easier to obtain as none of the forces would enjoy a special protection from the state. This is a polite way of asking what would happen to multinational capitalism if it could not rely on the armed forces of nation states to uphold its property rights in both rich and poor nations. Suppose that primary producers decided it was more sensible to feed and clothe themselves rather than make other people rich in grabbing an increasingly competitive slice of a global market. Now, just as history hasn't happened in the way that the Fabian or Marxist philosophers anticipated, so it has also failed to fulfil the hopes of the best-known anarchist thinkers.
William Godwin, the rationalist, would have been surprised and appalled by the re-emergence of religious and nationalistic fundamentalism. But so, of course, are all of us. Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, the advocate of mutualism, would have been appalled today at the way the building societies, which began as organs of working-class self-help, have been tumbling over themselves to become capitalist banks. Indeed, I've argued myself in this building that British social policy took the wrong turning when the Fabians denigrated the whole edifice of self-help and mutual aid bodies built up since the early 19th century in favour of universal social welfare through the machinery of state. We've learnt how vulnerable this is. Or another of those celebrated big four of the anarchist thinkers, Michael Bakunin, the apostle of insurrectionism, would have had his rhetoric undermined by the fate of all popular insurrections since his day. But for the fact that in his disputes with Marx in the 1870s, he accurately forecast the history of the Soviet Empire with his well-known claim that while liberty without socialism is privilege and injustice, socialism without liberty is slavery and brutality. Peter Kropotkin himself, the scientific optimist, would feel chastened by real events in the real world, but for several interesting utterances of his late years. In 1919, in the midst of the civil war that followed the Russian Revolution, he wrote that today, after the cruel lessons of the last war, it should be clear to every serious person, and above all to every worker, that such wars are inevitable so long as certain countries consider themselves destined to enrich themselves by the production of finished goods and divide the backward countries up amongst themselves so that these countries provide the raw materials while they accumulate wealth themselves on the basis of the labour of others. He was describing the consumer sovereignty that we experience every week in the global supermarket. And in the same period, for the post-war reprint of his book about work, Fields, Factories and Workshops, Kropotkin added a significant comment that links him with today's green movement and its recognition of the folly of assumptions of endless economic growth. For he explained that that book of his, he said, it pleads for a new economy in the energies used in supplying the needs of human life, since these needs are increasing and the energies are not inexhaustible. I think there's a great deal to be learnt from the anarchist tradition, but I know that all ideological positions are hampered by their past, hence the current dilemma of all three major political parties. A Dutch friend of mine, Rudolf de Jong, remarked recently that if some selected virus killed off all the world's anarchists tomorrow, as well as their ample literature, anarchism as an idea would re-emerge in every kind of society. So in looking for the re-emergence of anarchism in the 21st century, I'll forget the anarchist past and take as my guide a half-remembered book by a veteran of social investigation and social invention known to everybody here, Michael Young. In 1958, Michael Young gave a new word to the language in his satire, The Rise of the Meritocracy, which, if you remember reading it, was allegedly the work of some future scholar whose conclusions are never reached as his manuscript broke off during some 21st century insurrection. This imaginary historian, looking back on our own day, sees it as one where two contradictory principles for legitimizing power were struggling for mastery: the principle of kinship, whose child you were, and the principle of merit. Merit wins in the end, with earlier and earlier educational selection, and a new non-self-perpetuating elite is formed of what Michael Young termed the 5% of the population who know what 5% means. The top jobs go to the top brains, and payment by merit, summarized in the formula M equals IQ plus E, E for effort, and payment by merit widens the gap between top and bottom people. The people at the bottom are not only treated as inferior, they know they're inferior. new social tensions arise, and a populist movement consisting of an alliance of rejected people with dissident intellectuals, mainly women, arises. They produce the Chelsea Manifesto of the year 2009, which turns out to be the spark that eventually leads to the disturbances of 2033 and the gutting of the Department of Education. We don't know what happens next in Michael Young's fable, because the alleged historian loses his life in the Peterloo demonstration of 2034. But you really remember the Chelsea Manifesto. It declared that the classless society would be one which both possessed and acted upon plural values. Were we to evaluate people not according to their intelligence and their education, their occupation and their power, but according to their kindliness and their courage, their imagination and sensibility, their sympathy and generosity, there could be no classes. The classless society would also be the tolerant society, in which individual differences were actively encouraged as well as passively tolerated, in which full meaning was at last given to the dignity of man. Now, of course, Michael Young was writing his fantasy almost 40 years ago, in the far-off era of full employment. If he was producing it today, no doubt the letter E in his formula, the formula M equals I Q plus E, would be changed from effort to entrepreneurial flair. But the preconditions for explosive resentment are with us today to a far greater extent than they were when he was writing. Just consider the implications of Will Hutton's lecture on the 30-30-40 society, which is printed in the March issue of the Royal Society of Arts Journal. You see it in the library over there. He reminded us of the grisly new categorisation of British society, and he makes the implication clear. Hutton draws our attention to the fact there is a bottom 30% of unemployed and economically inactive people who are marginalised. Another 30% who, while in work, are in forms of employment that are structurally insecure. And there are only 40% who can count themselves as holding tenured jobs which allow them to regard their income prospects with any certainty. But even the secure top 40% know they are at risk. Their numbers have been shrinking steadily for 20 years. Hutton goes on to describe the dilemmas and crises faced by each of these groups. There is the fear for the bottom 30% that, as he put it, marginalisation will change into complete social and economic exclusion. While for the 30% of the newly insecure, as again I'm quoting Hutton, the social institutions and systems built up over the past 50 years to protect against risk are decaying. Meanwhile, the struggle to maintain living standards has meant ever longer working hours, so that not only parenting suffers, but, as he puts it, the capacity to sustain friendships outside of work, to become a member of local clubs and societies, to play a part in the local neighbourhood, it all reduces as hours worked rise. Hutton concludes that one day the pendulum will swing back, because it must. It certainly must. Hutton was retailing social facts known to everyone here, and in considering the reinvention of anarchism in the next century, I would like to take the last of his points first. I'm very much influenced by a perception of a non-anarchist, Martin Buber, in his lecture on society and the state, given many, many years ago, where he distinguished between the social principle and the political principle, and he argued that the result of the dominance of the political principle of power, hierarchy and dominion over the social principle of voluntary association for common need, the dominance of the one over the other, results in a continual diminution of social spontaneity, in Buber's phrase, in the form of the ability and willingness to play a part in the community. almost the same phrases that Michael Hutton was using about the effect of ever longer working hours for those people who are in work. This point of view had a very striking confirmation from another non-anarchist source in a recent study of civic traditions in modern Italy, the book called Making Democracy Work by Robert Putnam from Harvard, Robert Leonardi from this school, and Raffaele Nanetti from Chicago. This book has very recently been published in translation in Italy and has caused a great deal of discussion there, because after all it's a country with a corrupt state apparatus but a strong society in the north and a fatally weak social tradition in the south. But let me turn to Hutton's main point, the fear that for a significant proportion of the population marginalisation will change into complete social and economic exclusion. We're already familiar with this phenomenon in American cities, and it's now visible in European public housing estates. Research based in this school has shown how in Britain 70% of tenants in the forlorn enclaves of public housing on the fringes of British cities are, for lack of work, obliged to depend on minimum benefits from the state, and of course are consequently seen as a drag on the economy rather than as a wasted human resource. Anne Power and her colleagues have reported on efforts to divert the government's window dressing policies into attempts to support rather than ignore local self-organisation. One of her reports is very significantly, it seems to me, called Swimming Against the Tide, and she reminds us that there are examples of residents in very marginal areas taking over major responsibility for their areas in very difficult conditions and bringing about remarkable improvements through local organisation. This process, she says, enriches individual lives and transforms collective conditions. They are indeed swimming against the tide. And Dr. Power reminds us that the conflict on the estate in the 1990s is often within communities, between young tearaways and community activists. This is the time of year, for example, when people in housing management look at the weather and say, it's the joyriding season's beginning. And she notes that the behaviour of young males, including their threatening and victimisation of objectors, seem to reflect deep alienation. Indeed, she points out, several young joyriders were killed in frantic getaway attempts. The police seemed powerless, and unlike in the 1980s, community leaders denounced their own young men, as well as the outside world. The actions of the youth were an attempt at short-term power against long-term hopelessness. Politicians of all parties respond with a series of punitive answers, like putting those of the wild young males into military corrective establishments, or putting up for adoption the babies of the unsupported young females. Many of them revolve around the habit of blaming the underclass for its own fate, although the political analyst Peter Kellner was bold enough to say, "My target is different. I blame the overclass." Well, so do I. But I can recognise that the glib espousal of the supremacy of the market in the last decades of the 20th century is going to exact a penalty in the early decades of the 21st. Our predictions of the immediate future are determined more by temperament than by calculation of risks and likelihoods, and usually turn out to be wrong. It's usual to predict that the future is going to be just like the present, only more so. We can look to North and Latin and South America and see the affluent barricaded in a private world run by private armies of security guards, while the ghettos of the poor are dominated by local thugs and drug barons with their terrifying juvenile acolytes. Or we can study the long history of the concept of an underclass and notice how it evaporates in times of full employment. Its historian, John McNichol, pointed out to me that the underclass was decimated by the fact that there were jobs for all, both in Britain and the United States, and of course in Germany, during the two world wars. Fortunately, the prospect of a Third World War is diminishing unless we see it as a coming struggle between the global underclass of the poor world and the global masters of the rich nations over resources which the poor lack and the rich squander. My picture of the future has close links with the one that Michael Young described in that old satire of his, envisaging the Chelsea Manifesto of 2009 and the Peterloo demonstration of 2034. The manifesto, and the passage I've read to you makes that clear, his manifesto addresses the question of human dignity. Dignity. Now, what does the young urban criminal say in court or to the media when asked to explain his behaviour? He says words like, "All I wanted was a bit of respect." Or, "I hit him as he didn't show me any respect." Human beings desperately want to be valued. Whether or not we deserve respect from fellow citizens, we all care about human dignity, especially our own. This is why, if I'm asked about anarchism in the 21st century, I see it emerging from endless local struggles for influence down on the estate. On one side are those heroines and heroes of local community action. They usually are heroines, as we know, of local community action, battling for consensus over physical improvements, starting mother and baby groups, play groups, food co-ops, credit unions, lets, ventures, and a whole range of activities built around communality and mutual aid and self-help. They are usually women with a load of family obligations of their own, and they teach themselves the complexities of coping with local government and with the welfare system. On the other side are the vandals, arsonists, racists, joyriders and drug peddlers, quite apart from the loan sharks and tally men exploiting the day-to-day, hand-to-mouth, improvisatory economy of the poor. The huge task is that of winning over the piratical Thatcherite individualism of the antisocial power of the young into the camp of social action and effective community action. This approach has had a few victories. Well, one of them was undoubtedly that of making the poll tax uncollectible. You will recognise that the phenomenon that I'm talking about is social control. And you know it's a very equivocal phrase which has two opposite meanings. It's usually taken to imply the way in which the rulers of a nation state manipulate the behaviour of citizens through the police, the army if necessary, the legal and penal system, the management of information and of the media. But the sociologist who coined that term 95 years ago, Edward Allsworth Ross, American, meant something quite different. He studied frontier societies in 19th century America, a topic with which we are all familiar from our lifetime of watching westerns. We know all about the goodies and the baddies gradually enforcing the rule of law. Ross showed how social control was not achieved by romantic individualists, like the stars of the films we'll watch, nor by the agents of remote government, the US cavalry, but by the people who are bit players in the Western sagas, the women homemakers with a vested interest in continuity and security, the teacher, invariably a woman, in the little red schoolhouse, the newspaper editor and printer, invariably a man wearing a green eye shield, with his fearless publication of the truth, and the preacher reminding the powerful that if they gained the whole world, they lost their own souls. Now, it's a bit like that in today's forlorn housing estates, where nobody goes unless they live there or have business to transact there. They are our unglamorous internal frontiers on the underside of British society, and most of Europe has precisely the same phenomenon. There is the same struggle to win support for social values against the rugged individualists and tough guys. There's nothing surprising about the fact that another of your visiting professors, Stanley Cohen, in his pessimistic and honest book of 10 years ago, discussing the world of crime and punishment, his book called Visions of Social Control, concluded that, in his words, "Mutual aid, fraternity, and good neighbourliness still sound better than dependence on bureaucracies and professions," and that this, in his view, this means coming back to the political philosophy most consistent with sociology, namely anarchism. Well, naturally, I agree with him. But those of us who hold to this belief have a new burden to carry, that of the concept of communitarianism, favoured by Amitai Etzioni, welcomed among politicians of all parties, both here and in the United States, where this concept turns out to be part of the culture of contentment, seeking to reduce the expense of welfare payments and of policing in the poverty belt that surrounds every American city. To me, community control, if or when it becomes effective, will result in devastating challenges for not only government, but for the controllers of capital and finance. For we all know, we've all been taught, till we're sick of it, that the aim of the managers of capital today is to do without labour. And when it has to be hired, to do so on terms which are casual, part-time, and carry no obligations at all. The unemployed are blamed for not having the new computer skills that are in demand. But if they acquire them, they find that email and satellite communications enables tonight's software problem to be solved in Bangalore, India, with the answer beamed in tomorrow morning by highly skilled workers earning a fraction of the British wage for software engineers. And the ideology of dispensing with the labour force has spread to the distributive and service industries, to government and local government, and even to those branches of public employment concerned with servicing the needs of impoverished communities. The deprived and the people charged with serving their needs find themselves increasingly in the same boat. It's an absurd and explosive situation, and sooner or later it's going to explode. Just as Michael Young forecast ironically, we are going to see early in the next century an alliance of rejected people with dissident intellectuals, mainly women. They will be asserting the aims and values familiar to the whole tradition of anarchist propaganda over the last century, which I've deliberately refrained from talking about. There are plenty of histories around. I'm concerned with the re-emergence of anarchism in the next century in Britain, which is undoubtedly by now the most centralised country in Europe, and especially the country where revenue gathering is most concentrated in the central state. Everyone here will recognise that the level of their local council tax is determined not by good or bad management of their local authority, but by central government's manipulation of its budget. This reinvented anarchism will probably not use that word, but will demonstrate some common characteristics with those tendencies known in Latin America as basismo, from the base, developing as new social movements encompassing what are described in South American terms as protest and conflict, lobbying and pressuring government agencies and politicians, as well as self-help development projects, of which the most frequently cited are popular education, self-built housing, consumer or producer cooperatives, and community health care. I'm quoting that definition of basismo, from David Lehman's book on democracy and development in Latin America, in which he attempts to classify and describe the multifarious popular movements in that continent, which certainly have resonances for local community activists in this country. He explains that basismo proclaims its democratic identity, but it distrusts the formal apparatus of the modern state, emphasizing democracy as an educative and solidarity-building activity of face-to-face groups. Democracy for a basista is a matter of overcoming and undermining unwarranted forms of domination. Domination derived from economic power is illegitimate. Domination by political power, whatever its origins, is presumed to be self-interested, moved by shadowy levers and motivations. Hence the preference for political activity involving the physical presence of the grassroots, protesting, petitioning, and getting in the way of the few smooth running of a machine. And David Lehman goes on to describe how, in the light of these ideological resistances to involvement in formal politics, it is not surprising that communal self-management and collective consumption trade unionism — I'll come to what on earth he means by that in a minute — and collective consumption trade unions have become the main practical vehicles of secular basismo. Communal self-management is not the same as local government and does not aim to replace local government because it does not have any pretensions to become an organ of the state. It can rather be described as a proposal for the management of public goods by their beneficiaries. It's a recipe for the proliferation of organisations rather than the accumulation of power, one each in each area for sewage, housing, lighting, education and so on. Now, what does he mean by collective consumption trade unionism? He cites a paper by Robert Wade. Incidentally, if anybody is interested in what I'm quoting from, come and see me afterwards because I've got a list, a book list for you. What does he mean by collective consumption trade unionism? He cites Robert Wade's paper on the management of common property resources, collective action as an alternative to privatization or state regulation. And he explains that collective consumption trade unionism is not, as its critics sometimes claim, merely another set of pressures placed on the hapless representatives of the state to provide anything from schools to transport to urban services and nursery schools. It is also a more sustainable form of unionism because it's built on a tacit assumption of fiscal bankruptcy. In these circumstances, to press for and obtain collective goods may improve the quality of life as much as or more than conventional trade unionist attempts to raise wages, especially in times of inflation. A sewage system is less likely to be eroded by inflation, for example, than a percentage wage increase, though it can hardly be regarded as a substitute for it. Even without inflation, the difficulties of translating private purchasing power into, for example, a sewage system are substantial. Innumerable people with the same purchasing power are also trying to get their hands on the state's depleted budget. But the pessimistic assumptions of the dilemma do not necessarily hold in a small-scale context where people know each other and where they have the opportunities to learn and thus to modify their own and each other's behaviour over a period of time. Now, most people here will be familiar with one or another of the very many studies of popular self-organisation of this kind in very poor communities in Latin America, or with, say, Peter Lloyd's description of them as slums of hope, the name of a celebrated book of his, The Penguin. In the cities of the rich world, the poor are reduced to a condition not of hope, but of despair. Hence the alienation of the young, positively at war with their environment and with each other, who are the biggest obstacle to the spread of local self-management and the growth of a community economy among the people who've been cast away by the market and its values. Now, Kropotkin, whose definition of anarchism I read to you, struggled with this issue, and he concluded many years ago, well over a century ago, he said, "Of course, in every society, no matter how well organized, people will be found with easily aroused passions who may from time to time commit antisocial deeds. But what is necessary to prevent this is to give their passions a healthy direction, another outlet. Family life, based on the original community, has disappeared. A new family based on community of aspirations will take its place. In this family, people will be obliged to know one another, to aid one another, and to lean on one another for moral support on every occasion. And this mutual prop will prevent the great number of antisocial acts which we see today." Kropotkin was always an optimist, but you can see the connection between his remarks and the remarks I quoted from Professor Cohen. The wild young men seem to be living out a Wild West scenario of their own. So let me remind you again of the conclusion of that pioneer sociologist, Edward Aldsworth Ross, and the meaning he gave to the term social control established without the benefit of legal and punitive authority. He said, "Sympathy, sociability, the sense of justice and of resentment are competent under favourable circumstances to work out by themselves a true natural order, that is to say, an order without design or art." Now, this is the meaning that I ascribe to anarchism in the 21st century. We have to make the circumstances favourable, which even I wouldn't say that they are today. Thanks very much.
Colin, in good anarchist fashion, has left us with some time for questions and discussion. So, if anybody has anything to add, ask, or contribute, go ahead.
Yes. Colin, do you speak the anarchism in the 21st century?
Can you speak up, please?
Do you see anarchism in the 21st century? Since Keynes, because all the references you gave were references to Keynes. And in that sense, do you think men are now natural atomizers of each other?
I was putting it that way, since many of the old quotations which I depended on used the term men for the human race, and but also because it is a fact that the germs of community action and community development in these godforsaken estates that I was talking about, the people doing the work there, the social organisation and the development of social control, are almost invariably women. I think anybody in the housing field will say that this is so.
What will guarantee the prevention of a hierarchy rising out of this social control community organization? Because in any organization, if you take civilian communities, for instance, certainly the mafia is an example of probably a communitarian society who then hierarchizes itself. So how would that be prevented in the 21st century?
I don't have any guarantees about that, because we all remember the book Political Parties by Roberto Michels, in which he invented the phrase the iron law of oligarchy, and the oligarchs might very well be the mafia in the instance that you cite, or the organisers of some federal organisation. There are no guarantees, either in the past or the future, for that happening. Hence, in the material I was quoting relating to Latin America, the very conscious self-definition of fascismo, working from the base. Now, perfectly obviously, those community activists in Latin American cities are fighting their local equivalent of the mafia. But no, there are no guarantees. Unless we're aware of it, this is a tendency which is going to happen, yes. Me, I'm a non-violent man, but I don't think that we have any guarantees against the use of violence in social change. I do see an inevitable burst of resentment coming up from the marginal areas of society, just as in his jocular way Michael Young did years ago. You had better ask the management. I'm just a visitor. I think that people in the teaching profession certainly feel job insecurity at the moment. We have only to see the example of schools, which in order to balance their budgets are dispensing with teachers. A fatal, disastrous thing, it seems to me.
Have you noticed and make any comments on the current land occupation down by Wandsworth Bridge?
Yes, I was talking there the other night. I think it is an interesting tendency. It's a slightly different issue than the one which I am talking about, but you can say that that comes from resentment against the fact that that land has been sterilised for years while its owners, who had nothing to do with generating any wealth from it in the past, determine what is going to be the most profitable use for it. And I think that those campaigners are perfectly correct in their slogan about reclaiming the inner city. One of the reasons why we are going to have violent insurrection in the next century, which someone was asking about, is because we have seen the global movement of basic industries in this country to other parts of the world, coinciding with the belief that that job creation, in a Keynesian sense, is somehow wicked and blasphemous and so on. So, of course, we had this this vacuum. I could, in my optimistic phase, talk about these developments which various people call the community industry efforts to generate employment locally in actual productive work. But of course I know, just as you know, that these efforts are minuscule in the work that they provide. But the collapse of employment combined with the collapse of faith in generating employment seems to me part of the explosive situation which we are facing. Even to the extent, I mean, it's very glib, and people like me are always doing it, say, well, you know, never mind the absence of jobs, let's increase local service, community service industry. But in fact, all such industries, like the example I chanced to mention of the sacking of teachers, are going in the opposite direction. I'm not wrong, am I, in saying that the object of not just of capital, but the object of employers of every kind is to do without labour. And those figures produced by Will Hutton indicate that we have a disaster coming up in the early years of the next century. Of course, the underclass is a pejorative term, but as and I've discussed this at length with one of the theoreticians of the underclass, who has a view very like yours, John McNichol, and he, of course, stresses that the moment
opportunities for employment arise, the underclass evaporates. And the extreme case was the one which we cited of the Second World War. Being a historian, he also points out, you know, that in Victorian times and early in this century, we still had this this underclass notion popping up, but with under different names, and the availability of work evaporates it. People do, just as you say, work their way into what some of us see as society instead of a submerged tent. But I don't see this happening without the prospect of a war. Do you? Do you see some economic term which is going to provide employment, with absorbing this this bottom percentage of the permanent job list? Can you see that happening in the next few years without a change to a deliberate vast job creation program which no politician is willing to advocate? It's interesting, it's very interesting to look at the municipal estates in this light, isn't it? And 20 years ago we were all saying, well, we're not going down the American path, which was concentrating the very poor or the unemployed in public housing, because that is the sure way to pull down public housing. But every aspect of government policy in the last 10 years has been to do precisely that. And I wish some housing person here would comment on this. Yeah.
Wasn't it the consistent way to actually start talking to the Russian Revolution? I mean, what we're talking about is that we may be employed in a consistent way. We can't hold that for too long.
Yes, well, I would like to see one of our politicians promising a basic guaranteed income for all. If you remember, years ago, several American writers, I think Robert Theobald, and I think Galbraith, was advocating, what was the phrase used, cyclically graduated compensation, meaning that when unemployment is low, then the dole, however we chance to describe it, goes down, and when unemployment is high, the dole goes up, in order, in the usual Keynesian way, to put purchasing power in people's hands. But what happens in real life is precisely the opposite, isn't it? And the old are suffering simply as a result of the state pension that they had paid in for all their working lives, not meeting the ordinary cost of living today. Too old to be delinquent. Yes. They grow up in a calmer social climate. I think I think I was anxious to depress everybody with my counsel of despair and talking about the social upheavals of the early part of the 21st century. And then what you would need to do is to respond with vast job creation, Keynesian-type programs. But I see no politician actually saying this. I see plenty of people telling us in the Sunday papers, you know, maybe Keynes was right, and certainly this is desirable, but you won't find a politician saying that. Or an economist, I think, saying that. Well, I'm very grateful for your intervention, I must say, but you've raised so many points. First of all, this last one about anarchism is unimportant. As you notice, I have been talking about the reinvention of anarchism in different circumstances in the next century. I haven't given you any of the standard anarchist patter. I don't think that anarchism is equated with individualism. You've read the wrong anarchist, but every anarchist says that. But the other point, I too had this feeling of bewilderment, and like you, I've been an occasional visitor to cities in the United States. The first thing I find is that every American city is surrounded by a poverty belt of absolute unbelievable poverty. People say you're mad to go there, you know, because I just street map and wander, being an old gent. But you and I, if unemployment in the United States is now standing at 5%, you and I are just fated to meet that 5% whenever we go to an American city, I think. Going back to the crisis of American municipal housing, which is paralleled in a minor key by the, perhaps not a minor key, by the crisis of local authority estates in this country. You remember when I was a vandal pundit, I used to watch in tenants association meetings. I was asked to talk at the BBC film of the blowing up of that estate in St. Louis called Pruitt Igoe, that prize winning bit of architecture which was blown up by the US Army very scientifically, and the tenants of course all cheered to see this, but what we weren't told by the people who produced that material was, of course, that was one of let's say 17 municipal housing estates in St. Louis, the ones that they didn't blow up. What happened to them? And what happened in some cases was that the housing authorities went to the Rockefeller Foundation and said, what should we do to revive our estates, wanting some big handout. And having tried every possible solution, they adopted the solution which I would recommend, which was to turn it over to the tenants. Now this was pretty hard, because for one thing there were certain jobs on those estates which by tradition were white jobs, and they were going now to be given to black people. But time and again, and you will have experienced this too, in those downtrodden American cities, it's some woman with a large family, lots of problems of her own, and probably junkie kids or something of that sort, who emerges as the person who galvanizes that kind of action into that form of social control which gets rid of the drug peddlers. Precisely what Ross, what really happened in the Wild West, was talking about. This is another reason for my emphasis on the role of women, I think, in this. But I do agree with your point. Do you feel that you're just unlucky like me in just going to the places where all that 5% lives? Perhaps this is why Galbraith uses this phrase about the culture of contentment, because being housing people, we go to the housing problem areas and don't realise that beyond there are acres and acres of contented people.
Well, that's a suitably non-apocalyptic message to end. I was getting a little worried. However, many, many thanks for a very, very invigorating, fascinating talk.
Thank you.
There is a reception in the senior common room to which all, one and all, are invited. Well, that's on the fifth floor.